In times of real trouble, elected officials rise to the occasion.
The only way to build a thriving economy is to set and enforce firm rules of the world.
They did not do enough. There was not a whole lot of stimulus of you know, actual infrastructure.
Is hyperinflation a successful outcome of what they're trying to do?
To just realize that these people don't know what's going on.
The strong rights theory we turn to today is libertarianism.
You don't have to use fiscal stimulus or monetary stimulus. There is a third way.
We don't know how other people should live, and you cannot organize a society.
The case for the free market, the case for liberty, and the case against statism.
All right, welcome everybody to the Christian Mullins Show on a November 5th, 2013. And we have our first guest. We have Fabian Lamos. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. He is a student at the University of Delaware, and he is a fellow anarcho-capitalist. Me and him are the only anarcho-capitalists in the United States, evidently. We basically met each other through a youth and government seminar last year, and we basically our duties were to have the great enjoyment of just dealing with a lot of statists and standing up and voting against every single bill that happened because, they're just ridiculous. So, welcome Fabian. We're going to, I have a couple questions, that we're going to talk about anarcho-capitalism here, and let's, see what you have to answer. Cause I'm interested. I don't have a lot of anarcho-capitalists to talk to, but, at least I can see what your opinion is.
All right, man. Let's go.
All right, so first off, I guess the good question to ask is, in your mind, so what is anarcho-capitalism? We hear it a lot. So how would you describe it in your way of thinking?
I have it as sort of an absence of forced statism, not an absence of, like, social, what would be a good word for it? Social tendencies, yeah. Or social, mindsets or economic mindsets, but rather a lack of it being forced upon someone. So in today's society, no one kills anyone, no one steals anything, no one trespasses because it's illegal. And in an anarcho-capitalist society, no one steals because they don't want to be stolen from, no one kills because they don't want anyone else killed. Nobody trespasses because they don't want you to trespass on their things. So in that sense, it goes back and forth. And in today's society, the punishment for it is jail time, which is essentially you being put somewhere you don't want to. You forcibly have to do something else, which, in my mind, if the state's doing it, why can't people do it? So, right. Yeah, because it's wrong.
So, like, private contracts or stuff like that.
Yeah, reciprocate certain tendencies and certain actions that you wouldn't want done to you. You don't hurt other people because you don't want to be hurt.
Yeah, all by right. Them. Yeah, that makes sense. So you talked about the state in there, and a lot of people, I know this is kind of, elementary, but you say the state, like, obviously you mean the government. So
Yeah. In
your mind, I mean, we have this as a society, kind of this benevolent caretaking view of the government. So how would you describe the state? It's like, what is the actual institution in, like, the blunt terms? What is it actually?
Blunt sort of poli-sci terms. The state is a centralized unit of government. And of course their power, like, is split up into the 50 United States we have today, and then local governments, municipalities, and anything lower than that. But in the broad poli-sci terms, it's any – I define the state as any entity that, like, makes you do things, makes you pay taxes, makes
has
you –
has a monopoly on force.
Yeah. Yes, monopoly on force would be a good way to put it.
Yeah.
And monopoly to direct force where it's needed, monopoly to – take certain assets or certain values that someone has and change them to somewhere else. And by values, things, not like beliefs. Sorry.
No, you're fine. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's basically it's a group of people that declare themselves to be above the moral and civil law of the non-aggression principle, which we'll get into. We talked to a little bit yesterday on the podcast. And I think the best way I've seen it put is to kind of put it into context is in Murray Rothbard's Anatomy of the State. He basically talked about a hypothetical where just a group of people, they're bandits. And if they have enough power and have enough, force and military power, they can take over a specific geographical region. And then if they can maintain it, they are no longer just the group of bandits that can use force. They are now, some divine benevolent institution that, helps everyone. So it's that kind of idea where, like, as Fabian said, it's that, it's the idea that they have these certain qualities that in our society, in our lives, we just, we don't have. We don't have the, you know, the initiation of force to solve our problems. I mean, it's a completely separate entity that, just, I mean, it's completely immoral, and it's, I know it's kind of hard to see that, and it takes a while to get there, so I guess this kind of works into my next question, which is, that's kind of a hard, it's a, you know, it's not a popular understanding of the state to hold, so basically, I kind of want to ask you, what led you, like, what was the steps that you took to get to an ANCAP? What events happened that you kind of clicked into being an anarcho-capitalist?
Well, when I was little, I would always like try to get into politics and stuff because it was always something that kind of interested me. So I remember this one distinct thing from when I was little is police officers. Like you'd hear on the news, like the cops would just beat down on someone. That you'd see, like, everyone's seen that picture of like a cop walking down the street with like pepper spray and then just hitting like five people in the face as they were going down. And for what seemed like no reason, like they were handcuffed or something, and the cop was just sitting there just beating down on them. Well, with the pepper spray. And so then when I was little, I had this idea, oh, if a cop ever does something to a citizen, they have to videotape it to see how they're actively hurting people. So that was when I was little, and that was just something, that was a good story I wanted to tell. And more recently, like whenever I defined myself as an anarcho-capitalist, call it the beginning of my junior year. And so 2 years ago now, actually, yeah. And I was really into like watching all the YouTube videos, and a guy who really got me was obviously Jesus. Now,
well, obviously.
Yeah, obviously. Now, I doubt you'll be able to find anything that I really liked on his YouTube channel now, because he got into this big like YouTube argument with this other guy. Actually, I won't even say who it was, because if you know who he is, you'll know what it is, and then I don't want to like perpetuate it.
You can if you want to.
All right.
You don't have to.
I don't know. It's like the argument was really like uncivil and really like ill. Yeah. It represents how he was in his videos and how they both are, really. So you probably won't be able to find them, but I really, really liked what he said. And a lot of it was ANCAP and really hardline atheist. I didn't agree with 100% of it, but I agreed with most of it just because there are certain tendencies that I –
does tap into that like childhood consistency where you're like if you're a kid you can't go and steal someone else's toys, right? There's it's your property, you can't initiate force, all of that in that one little circumstance. And it kind of is like, wow, possibly through this philosophy, those kind of things that we believed in as children, that we teach our children, can actually apply to us adults too. So it does have that kind of, we kind of like bury it down, and then when you kind of hear it, you're like, huh, This could actually, you know, be practical. But did you have a stage where you, before, did you go straight to anarcho-capitalist, or did you have anything before that as far as political philosophy whatsoever?
Of course, when I was a little kid, I didn't really count that piece. I didn't really know too well. Yeah, once I was fully, like, taught about all this, I was libertarian for a while, but that's just because that's what I could write on a piece of paper at the DMV. And I got my license and stuff, but pretty much it was always ANCAP. I didn't really sort of step into it. I picked up some things when I was little, like just hearing people talk, and I was like, I agree with that. And it turns out that was something like Ron Paul or something said. And I agree with what he says, and that was like another libertarian GOP member. So it was pretty much always in that direction. I just never labeled myself an ANCAP until I heard the term. I was like, oh, okay, that fits me pretty much 100%. Let's go.
Wow, see, not everyone, especially me, I did not have that kind of easy going where I kind of just got truth like that. I had various stages. I was always into politics, and I did get trapped in the party game. I never was like saying like, you know, Republicans are great, Democrats are bad, and vice versa. I always said both the parties are corrupted, but I was always a conservative until about 2 years ago. And I was this, I look back now, and there's some things that I look back onto, and I don't know if you probably didn't have this because you weren't a conservative at any point, it sounds like, but I actually had a point in time where I supported Rick Santorum for presidency. Yeah. And I look back,
pornography.
I know.
That's hilarious.
It's a big change. And then, so I went from there, and, I became a libertarian about a year and a half ago, where I basically was like, this doesn't mean you need to be consistent. There needs to be principles behind what you do in life. And I guess I was a libertarian for a while, and then I guess the anarcho-capitalism came in. My first kind of taste of it was I was in a history class. I think it was 2 years ago, and we were going over the Great Depression. And my teacher, basically, the correct answer that she believed was it wasn't the New Deal that got us out of the Great Depression; it was World War II. So I basically thought, okay, it wasn't government spending; it was government spending, which completely made. It made no sense. So I went and I looked up the Great Depression. And I came over Murray Rothbard's book, America's Great Depression, and that was really what got me into it. And then I kind of slowly got into it. I'm not going to go too much farther because this is going to interfere with the next question. But then that's where it really got me to the state of a hard libertarian before I got into direct ANCAP. So I guess the next question I have is, okay, so you believe in this kind of it's this fundamental principled view that the state is immoral, it's unnecessary. But why isn't minarchy good enough, right? Why isn't the Ayn Rand version of, defense, jails, courts, why is that not correct? And why wouldn't that work in your mind?
In my head, minarchism is always like the stepping stone towards ANCAP. Yeah. It's always like you have as little as you can. I just don't think you need any. I think none is as little as you'd need, because ideally, you don't need jails because no one does anything bad. No one harms anyone. Everyone, you learned what the bad things. Now you learned what you shouldn't do when you were seven. Don't steal. Don't hurt people. Don't lie. Ideally, no one steals. No one hurts anyone. No one lies. No one does anything bad. Ideally, and it'll take a while to get there. So minarchism is sort of the stepping stone. You lose the training wheels of government as time progresses, as social constructs become more clear and people become more educated in social interactions. So then eventually you don't need it. Yeah, at the beginning you probably do need, some sort of central government because you need jails and stuff. But we shouldn't really be making policies towards a world that we don't think is perfect. And I think in a perfect world, it is anarcho-capitalist. The free market works itself out the way it should. Poverty is eliminated because everyone's progressing, the standard of living is increasing, social constructs are becoming more clear. Eventually you don't need it.
Yeah, I don't hold it as an idealist perspective, is that I don't believe that people will not rob or steal. The difference I guess I have is I believe that these institutions, I can agree with you on jail. I think jail is a completely ludicrous institution. It does far more harm than good. But I do believe in that the private sector can have these kinds of repercussions. And in my mind, and I kind of have to go with Stefan Molyneux's case on this, is the idea of a DRO, or dispute resolution organization, where these things will, it's like an insurance, right? You have insurance for your car, but now you can get insurance for defense. You can get insurance against people attacking you or stuff like that. And obviously, if you want to read his book, Practical Anarchy, it goes into great detail of how that would reason itself out. But yeah, I understand the position of these institutions. At least from my view, and I understand that you kind of differ a little bit. But in my view, it's the fundamental point that if you believe that the minarchist position is the correct one, that that we need these services done, that's, courts, defense, that the state cannot, if they're that important, the state cannot be left to do it, right? It's far too important for the state to be embedded in, and like any other product, it can be provided by the private sector more efficiently. So yeah, I think we differ a little bit there, but I think our overwhelming principle is the same, that the state is, the institute, it's not the proper institution, and that force is not the necessary mechanism for, law and defense and stuff like that. So I guess as far as this kind of gets into what I was talking about with, at least my view on the DRO, is wouldn't it just be chaos, right? Wouldn't it just be a bunch of people running around going insane? So what about any law? Would it be like a dispute resolution organization and the idea of insurance, or would that just simply be just not necessary in our capitalist society?
All right. Now, again, this is referring to something that I thought about a couple of years ago. I always thought that when I learned about the three sections of government, executive, legislative, and judicial branch, I thought that the judicial was the most important and the most necessary because it's what I think to be the most impartial. In legislative and executive, someone's always trying to better themselves, their party, or their constituents. In judicial, you're going black and white clear cut. So that's So I think it is the most necessary. So in my eyes, if someone were to like make me pick a section of government to keep, it'd be judicial. Oh, and education, but that's like a different thing. Now, no, I don't think it would be just utter chaos, because you wouldn't, because like I said earlier, you wouldn't want to steal things because the other people would be able to like defend what they have.
Yeah, they have. You can be in the contracts. You can have that. There are certain repercussions that would. It's the same way the law prohibits you now. The private contracts and the dispute, DROs could, if they were demanded for, they could take place and stop and disincentivize you from stealing or murdering, whatever it may be.
Yeah, and then, I mean, obviously there are going to be some people who are like, oh, I know, I'll just go steal everything because no one's going to be able to do anything to me. But guess what? Some guy's going to be sitting around with like his pump action shotgun waiting for, like thinking, oh, someone might steal things. I'm going to protect my stuff. So then eventually they both think, you know what? Maybe the other guy's not going to steal anything. Maybe I shouldn't steal anything from that guy. So both people end up, you know, going along their way. If they need something, they buy it, they trade for it, or whatever.
So basically, it's like the NRA wet dream, where everyone can carry shotguns and they can they can defend themselves, right? You know what I mean? And I mean, the gun control is a complete, obviously ludicrous argument, but that's the flip side of the non-aggression principle, private property rights, where you can, if you understand that someone can defend themselves, then you are going to be a lot. The incentives of stealing and, you know, doing anything that's negatively to the society, there's going to be far more repercussions than, you know, getting a welfare check or getting free food and housing in a jail.
So what you said about the NRA thing, every time I talk about someone with this, they think, oh, so you don't want it to be like the Wild West. Everyone's walking around with like revolvers and magazines in their pockets, and then we're going to shoot each other. Like, you kick the bar down, and if they don't give you your whiskey, you shoot them in the mouth. No, I don't think it's going to be like that. I think eventually you won't really need guns, because everyone's going to be like, oh, okay, it's fine. It's going to be – no one's going to steal anything, because you think that other people – because you don't want other people to steal from you. Eventually – at the beginning, yeah, people might start carrying around guns and stuff. But like today, I walk down the street, and I don't think anyone's going to like jump me and run my pockets and take my stuff.
So yeah, I mean, it's obviously not the presence of government control as you see in obviously Detroit or Chicago, where there's the massive legislation. It's the human progress that you know, kind of whittles that out, right? I mean, it's the same idea of slavery. The human race is going to progress as long as the non-aggression principle and private property rights are upheld. These kind of problems that we see today is what you know, who would pick the cotton back then? We obviously, capitalism, the free market can resolve those kind of problems. So I guess the second kind of deal with the practicality of it would be, comes from the perspective, I'm kind of playing devil's advocate, but when we learn in our history books, you know, capitalism and the free market, they completely destroyed the poor. We have all these welfare programs, and, you know, Social Security, we'd be nothing without them. People would be starving in the streets. So how would this society deal with the poor, the sick? How would they, you know, live? How would they find themselves in the society?
Now, I know a lot of ANCAPs will resort to the, like the philanthropist will donate money to them, or a lot of people will start donating more. Like, charities will become a much bigger organization than they are now. I think that, yeah, charities probably will become a much larger organization. But I don't really think that it will be so much to completely end the poor. And, of course, there are things like work laws today, which restrict people. Like, you need an address and a car, you need stuff like that. Eventually, like, you could just end up paying some guy $10 to take out your trash every morning. Like, you leave it out on your front porch, and maybe you have a big driveway or whatever. He comes up, throws it away, and there's his $10 every day. But obviously, that's not going to help. That's not going to completely fix it either. I think that eventually things are going to become more of a private contract between people, where if you are poor, you can always find like a job really easily, because people always need things to be done. You can get a job just out of the blue. You can get paid under what we would call today under the table. And that in the ANCAP society, it's just you get paid. Yeah. It becomes more readily available.
It's just decentralized. Yeah. I mean, And I think the idea, I mean, especially the biggest problem I've talked about this repeatedly before. As far as the poverty rate, I mean, I've said this like 17 times already in the last 2 weeks to other people, but In 1789, it was 95%. To 1960, it went down to like 20. And then and that was the Great Society programs, LBJ. And then since then, it's since, you know, 50 years, it's only went down like 4 or 5%. So, I mean, if we had these programs at the very beginning and we went on the same pace, we'd only be going down, we only would have went down 15% instead of 70. So, I mean, obviously, the poor are helped by the free market. And like he said, the decentralization of the money supply and getting the Federal Reserve out of the deal of interest rates and allowing people to control what they deem as money. And I mean, it's been proven over and over again to work. And as far as, I mean, it's the same thing. I mean, with healthcare, I mean, I think you would agree that the prices of healthcare are obviously way too high because there's special interests in the pharmaceutical areas and stuff like that, where it, like any other product that's not subsidized in the free market or you know, taxed in the governmental sector, that it would obviously, the price would go down over time like any other private product.
Yeah, a big one in that area would be like education, like the reason college is so expensive.
Yes, yes.
There's a Learn Liberty, it's another YouTube channel, does this really well if you want to check them out. They're going to explain it better than I am, but the way they say it is it's expensive because everyone needs to go to college and because government subsidizes college. So more people go to college, you can charge more for it and people will still pay for it. Just that's basic supply and demand.
Yeah, I mean, sorry, go ahead.
The government subsidizes colleges, which essentially makes it seem like there's more people who want to go to college. They promise student loans and such. So that makes it seem more expensive than it should be. Now, my solution to this is one of two things. Either completely remove student loans, which for a while there will be a lot of like complexity, a lot of sort of schools changing their tuition rates like damn near instantly. But another good solution, if you're still into like the whole centralized government and education type of deal, is to make high school education better. Because if high school education were better, then less people would need to go to college, because there'd be certain jobs where you don't need a college education, maybe just a really good high school education. And we all see how Europe's education system differs from ours.
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right as far as the high school education. I think even separate than that, I think, and at least I am hopeful that in the next 10 years, college just becomes completely irrelevant. It's obsolete. I mean, we have the internet where you can learn virtually anything you want for sufficiently lower price. And I think a lot of the college hangover, I like to say, is it's because, I mean, we believe that this document of the college degree is something that, you know, it's needed for certain jobs, where I think if people, you know, if people understood that the internet and, you know, doing free education is a practical way and they could actually get a job from that, I think, I mean, it would be a lot more beneficial. But yeah, as far, and I think it's, you're right. I mean, as far as the student loans go, I mean, it's a basic understanding. It's economic principle. People respond to incentives. And then if you take all the risk away from a company, they're going to be able to raise prices. If they're not worried about their demand decreasing, they're going to be able to raise prices. I mean, I understand. I mean, the government, if they're going to say your college tuition is $20,000, that's low. Say it's $20,000, right? And then your college, the government, it says, I'll insure it at $50,000. It doesn't matter how high you go. I mean, they're going to raise it because there's no risk. It's a fundable economic problem. That's one. It's one of the biggest solutions to just the entire education system. Is the government is just it's. I mean. Like you said, Europe is it's been a complete devastating failure. The next question I really want to ask is, you talked about the what led you to anarcho-capitalism earlier, but I kind of want to know if you could if you had a couple names in your head that you said these people were fundamental in changing my philosophy. Political, you know, economic, historic, any individual names or authors or speakers that really influenced you tremendously in your changes in your philosophy.
Yeah. So in addition to being an anarcho-capitalist, I'm also an existential nihilist, which I think both of those go really hand in hand in the fact that a lot of things are sort of subjective and you can't really make objective decisions based on your own perceptions.
Yeah.
So a few that I'll toss out are Friedrich Nietzsche, The Twilight of the Idols and the Antichrist.
Yeah.
That's a good nihilist read. If you're into that, I'll show it right here.
Yeah. Nietzsche's always a great author. I'm not a nihilist, but can you give a quick definition of people who, if you don't know what nihilism is, can you just give a quick definition?
Yeah, I don't have like a textbook definition on hand, but in for me, it's essentially that a lot human experience is entirely subjective. What you experience is different from what everyone else's experience is. So you can't really, I don't think you can make any objective standings morally, economically, or policy-wise based on your own perceptions, because they're your perceptions and they're not objective, because your senses, the way you interpret things, the way you process information, aren't objective either. So I couldn't I couldn't feel right making a law, like an objective law, about anything if it's based on my perspective, which it would be, because I'm the one who's thinking it. It'd be based on my interpretation of everything, of life.
Yeah, basically what I know of it is that it's that you cannot define any morality or whatever it may be. There's no distinct morals that a society can run around that aren't subjective. I'll let you go to the other authors in a sec, or if you have any other authors in a second. But I am not a nihilist. I actually do believe in the idea of a secular ethics. I would look up, if you wanted to take idea of it, look up Stefan Molyneux's books on he wrote a whole book on secular ethics, which is actually really great. I will say it takes a little bit, but if you actually open your mind to it, it's actually pretty interesting. But I am familiar with nihilism and people who are nihilists. So that is an important distinction. But go ahead with your with anyone else you've been influenced by.
Another one of the books that I read that I really liked is it's like a compilation of a bunch of European philosophers. It's actually just called European Philosophers from Descartes to Nietzsche. And in it, there are a number of people who I think are really, really solid that you should look up. And again, that leads me to nihilism, which helped me sort of solidify and cap.
Yeah.
And in it, they have a really solid interpretation of Immanuel Kant. I'm going to read through some of these. Man, Nietzsche, which are the two best in that book. And then, of course, Descartes, if you're into all that. Then The Prince by Niccolo Machiavelli. That's not an ANCAP or a nihilist book at all, but it's a good policy book and a good government-esque book if you're into that. I kind of just wanted to say it because I love this book. And then another compilation is I loaned that to my friend, damn it. It's just The Revolutionary Period, which, again, historical. It's like a historical thing about U.S. Revolution. And then this is like the most ANCAP book I have, even though it's still pretty pro-government, as I would put it. The Second Treatise of Government by John Locke. This looks like a picture book. Like it's huge, and it's a
rough read. It is. It's good, but it takes a while to get through. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's not thick, but it's not thick. It's just got a huge cover, and it's.
Yeah, that cover is misleading. I've read his that work. It's That's a misrepresentation of how long it is. I'm pretty sure he cut out like two-thirds of the pages out of that thing. you arrives here coming from more of a historical perspective. I obviously have my interest in economics is where I base it out of. So obviously I'm going to be coming from the Mises, Rothbardian kind of, you know, Hayek for economics wise. And then for anarcho-capitalist, I disagree with him significantly on monetary policy, but David Friedman, I'm a fan of as far as practicality and law and whatnot. And as a philosophical, so I'm minoring in philosophy. My probably one of the most fundamental people, especially with leading to atheism, was, again, I mentioned him twice already, who is Stefan Molyneux. He's they've been all fundamental with me, but I the economics kind of led to anarcho-capitalism with me compared to where you're coming from, which is kind of a more historical consequentialist perspective. But I have one more question. I think this is probably the most important question that any anarcho-capitalist has been asked, and I feel it's wrong that I haven't asked you yet. And that's like, what about the roads, man?
Well, everyone says, well, who built the roads? And my always like smart-ass answer is the same people who build them now. They need jobs, don't they? It's going to be the same people. But in all honesty, it'll be the same people. Well, it's just be smaller forms of government, smaller forms of people keeping them up. Like, let's say that, I don't know, you want to keep up the word on your street, so you'll gotta talk to you and be like, hey guys, we should all fix up our street together. So they pay like a road company or whatever, or they all band together and do it themselves. And of course that's like a big hippie commune way of seeing it. But of course, there'll be people who own really big plots of land, farmers and such, and then really rich people who have enormous properties of land who are like, would, instead of having just, you know, like acres and acres of property, they'll, I don't know, put up a neighborhood, charge people not too much to live there, I guess, or they could charge them a lot and make a good profit. But of course,
yeah, I think
people who would pay a lot wouldn't live there.
No, I think you're right. So it's kind of obvious. But a lot of people can't even get to that point. But I think if you step back, people will say, well, what if someone, that you build a house and then someone builds a road next to your house and they charge you $1 trillion each time to go on it. What's going to happen then? And the obvious answer, you can make all these hypotheticals up. And the obvious answer is that you're buying the land from someone else. And obviously, this is, I think, the biggest fundamental problem with people who don't kind of think of it. They have this top-down perspective, is that if you have these concerns, you will make sure these concerns are met in the contract when you sign to buy a house. You'll make sure that if someone does decide to build a road, or if there's a road already there, that they can't go past this limit or a reasonable increase in price. As far as the private roads, I love the questions of, well, are there going to be toll booths at each corner? Well, the fundamental idea, capitalism is the most innovative, the free market is the most innovative idea. We already have Easy Pass and stuff like that, could deal with that very easily. And people don't even think of that. Businesses like Walmart and like big, companies, or all of those big ass parking lots are private roads. They're maintained by Walmart. They're not the state-owned parking lot of government. I think that it is a joking question that we often get, which I had to ask you. I really did. I just love getting these questions. And probably my favorite answer that I've heard, and I say this every time now, is that where we're going, we don't need roads. And I love it.
Yeah. That's so good.
It is. It's priceless.
So good. So everyone always says that there's some fallacies in when we say what we think would happen with roads. But a key thing in capitalism is that we don't know. And that's the beauty of capitalism. I don't know what I would do about roads, about pharmaceuticals, about education. But someone does. Someone will know. Someone else is going to have a great, innovative new way to do it that's better than anything we could have thought of in this faux capitalist society that we're in today. Someone else is going to be able to do it. But I don't. That's the beauty of it. I can't figure it out. But somebody else will. Someone else is going to be able to come up with this new, brand new, innovative way of doing things, of doing anything, of, I don't know, how to get to school in the morning. They're going to think of this brand new way that we couldn't even begin to comprehend today. But now in the future, when everyone ideally is smarter and more well-prepared and well-educated and more just intellectual.
It's just increasing competition. It's all it really is. And I think that kind of principle, people are raised in an idea where there always has to be someone with a bullhorn, as Tom Woods puts it. Someone just has to be barking out orders. And probably the best way to deliver your point, if people want to go look it up, it's a short little poem/essay, and it's called I, Pencil by Leonard Reed. And what it basically is, it's coming from the point of view of a pencil who says, no one in the world can make me. And you're like, well, you just need, some wood, some rubber, some, whatever the hell the metal is. I don't even know. The point is, I'm not a pencil maker. That's the exact point. But if you think about it, what it has to go into, you have to cut down the wood to get the pencil wood. Well, you need a saw to do that. Where does the saw come from? From the iron ore. And you need something to get the iron ore out. So there's all of this cooperation going on the key point is that we cannot central plan what people are going to do. That's the whole point of anarcho-capitalism, that we don't know, and that people way smarter than we are in their respective fields can decide and find out best ways for things to work.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the beauty of capitalism, honestly, that there's so many people out in the world. One person's bound to know that how to, I don't know, like you said, make a pencil, make a book, make a road better than I can. I can't think of a good way of doing that road thing. I can't think of someone of a good way to sort of pay for roads, because obviously it's going to be either paid for or built. I can't think of a good way to maintain them, but I can't. Someone else will.
Yeah, and then that's the point. You don't even need to know, right? Because, you just need to know how to make your little part in the entire final product. The guy who, is cutting, the guy who cuts down the lumber doesn't need to know how the rubber is
the erasers made,
taken out, right? They don't need to know that. You just need to do one little part and let the competition work itself out. So, I'm happy we got to discuss these things. I think we disagree on some things, but the end goal, I think we both agree on. So I'm really happy that I actually could sit down and have a good conversation with you as far as this, because it's, again, in our demographic and our age group, it's not the easiest thing to find anarcho-capitalist wise. So I thank you for coming, we will be back tomorrow, Wednesday, November 6th. I don't know, we might be having a guest. I will let you guys know some point later on the YouTube channel. And if you haven't gone to my YouTube channel, you can subscribe. You'll get all of these video casts. I am recording this video cast of me, so you can get all of the highlights from that on youtube.com/the302productions, or you can subscribe on iTunes, The Christian Mullen Show. And so, guys, I thank you for listening. We'll be back tomorrow, and bye for now.